Les colloques du Collège de France.
What an honor it is for me to be here today joining this amazing gathering of distinguished scientists to celebrate your birthday, Stan. As you know, for me you've been a guiding mentor and a role model. Starting from the last year of my PhD, when I joined your lab as a visiting student coming from University College London, and throughout the initial and most important and formative years of my career, we have worked together very much, a lot. And it was a bless for me. It was fantastic and very inspiring, but sometimes quite challenging, I have to say. And speaking of challenges, even though I am not entirely sure that it was strictly necessary to schedule my talk right after that of a Nobel Prize winner, I thank you very much for having invited me here and give me the opportunity to share with you my latest research. So I am a psychologist, as many of you, and as such, I'm interested in human cognition. And in particular, I'm interested in those high-level cognitive functions that define us as humans, such as language, mathematics, and logical thinking. When we ponder upon these functions, we cannot but be marveled by the level of sophisticated abstractions that we are capable with in these domains. And even more so if we think that we are able to reach those abstractions starting from what is essentially a primate brain, evolved to fulfill basic survival and reproductive goals, and to solve relatively simple perceptual and motor problems to start. So one way that we all share is possible to attack this tension is to think that during development, even the most abstract form of cognitive functions in humans emerge thanks to the articulated interplay of a very small handful of extremely basic evolutionary ancient, potentially genetically determined system that we can refer to as core knowledge with LIS or startup systems that at the same time guide but also constrain development and learning. And of these systems, today I am going to concentrate to the one that allow us to deal with space. We just heard this beautiful talk before mine. Thinking about this system that allow us to navigate space and orient in it. Within the field of number processing and mathematics, there is already a very strongly converging evidence that spatial skills play a crucial role in mathematics. First of all, the two functions correlate in both children and adults. Not only that, but spatial skills are longitudinally predictive of later mathematical achievement in children. And in those children that struggle in learning mathematics, there is a high probability of them to be also impaired in spatial skills. But perhaps most importantly, thanks to the seminal work of Stan back in the 90s, discovering the snark effect, we know that numbers, such as central concepts for mathematics, are mentally represented in the form of spatially oriented continuum, the number lines, to the point that if we ask subject to randomly generate numbers, we can predict the number that they will generate by looking at the size and the amplitude of the movement of their eyes, such that the more they will generate a smaller number compared to the previous one, the more they will have looked towards the left during a spontaneous eye movement. One question is, what is the origin of these links between number and space? We have been thinking for a long time that the origin is cultural in nature, especially because the orientation of the association between number and space seem to follow the directionality of the writing system that the subject are adapted with. So for example, for us, numbers are oriented from left to right, but from people who are born born in culture in which they read and write from right to left, then they tend to associate number in this directionality. However, this idea struggled a little bit with some discovery in the animal domain, in which it is now clear that humans are not the only species that associate number to space. Many other animal species have shown to have this spontaneous association in a very peculiar directionality, though, preferring smaller quantity to be associated to the left and larger to the right, as exemplified by this very elegant and clear experiment from Vallortigara and colleagues with newly hatched chicks that were trained to find a reward behind the centrally presented panel onto which a given number of dots were presented. When during test, instead of one panel, the chicks were presented with two panels upon which the same number of dots were presented, they went straight towards the left panel when the number of dots depicted were smaller compared to the training number, and straight toward the right panel when the number of dots was increasing with respect to the training one. So we remain with this tension. Is this number to space associations in humans culturally or rather biologically determined? In order to try and approach this question, we collaborated with a group of psychologists led by Serge Caparos, who is here in Paris, that is an expert of the Himba culture. Himba is an indigenous population living in the northern Namibia in South Africa. And that is very interesting for us because their indigenous culture is very rich, but is entirely oral. So they are illiterate, they don't read and write. And we visited the Himba in two different missions. And we compare their performance in various tasks with that of young Italian preschoolers, pre-literate, basically without any strong input from the culture in writing and reading, and adult university students. So the first task was a very, very simple task that we asked these groups to perform. We gave them a stack of cards, randomly arranged cards, on which a different number of dots was depicted from 1 to 10. And we asked them, please, can you order these cards in a way that looks beautiful to you? This is only the only instruction that we gave them. First observation is that among all the possible spatial layout that they could have chosen, most of the subject in the four groups choose the lateral line, meaning that they created an horizontal line, suggesting already that this like unidimensional shape is kind of intuitive to be associated to numerical quantity. But then we went further, of course, and we quantified the exact sequence that the subject produced by correlating their own one to the canonical left to right oriented line, yielding to a correlation coefficient of 1 for perfectly oriented lines from left to right, minus 1 from perfectly oriented line from right to left, and 0 for when subject did align but did not use quantity to create this continuum. So the distribution of this coefficient of correlation indicated that only Italian adults actually consistently across subjects used the left to right orientation. The other population, the two Himba groups and the preschooler, while they actually use number to organize these cards, so they are sensitive to numerical quantity, they know how to count more or less, but somebody used the left to right and somebody else used the right to left. There was no convergence at the population level. This would suggest that without a strong, consistent cultural input coming, for example, from the directionality of writing, the number line maybe exists, but it's agnostic with respect to orientation. However, we reason that this task requires subject to think about consciously and make an explicit decision with respect to the relation between number and space. And it was very different from the kind of experiment that are used in animals. So we devised a computerized experiment in which we presented subject with the two sets of dots and asked them in a go-no-go paradigm to press a button only when, in some block, the second was bigger compared to the first one, or when the second set was smaller compared to the first one. Crucially, the second set was not presented in the center, but it was presented laterally from the fixation point. And this generated condition of compatibility with the canonical oriented number line. For example, a smaller set on the right was coded as incongruent, while a smaller set on the left was considered to be the congruent condition. So when we analyzed the congruency effect as the difference in the combination of reaction times and error rate that subject made between congruent and incongruent condition, we observed that all four populations behaved exactly the same. There was no significant difference in the way they behave, such that especially, and we can discuss why, for the decreasing task instruction, there was a significant congruency effect across all the population, suggesting that irrespective of whether somebody is trained to read and write in a certain direction, there is this bias to associate small numerosity to the left side of space and large numerosity to the right. So, as a conclusion of this initial part, the relation between number and space, in this particular sense, number lines, can be shaped by culture, this is undeniable, but it is not determined to start with by culture. Rather, it is possible, and our data suggest that, it emerges thanks to some neurobiological mechanisms that are conserved across species. We all have this behavior, and across ages and culture within humans. However, the exact nature of this mechanism that underlie this kind of behavior and preference is not really determined yet. Our working hypothesis is that it has to do with the functional asymmetries across the two hemispheres that are maybe conserved across at least the species that have been studied so far, but I don't have time to discuss it now. I will keep the talk short, such that if you are interested, we can discuss about this hypothesis later on. I want to move on now because beyond space and mathematics and numbers, I have been recently focusing my attention, expanding the field of my research onto language. And in particular, I've started being interested in semantic representations that are those representations of concept or categories that we hold in mind when we interpret known symbols or mainly most of the time words. It is interesting to notice that most of the researchers that have been pondering upon semantics representation almost inevitably ended up in using some sort of spatial metaphor to think about semantics, according to which concepts or semantic representations, for me these two terms are equivalent in this talk, are conceived as points in a high-dimensional internal space where proximity reflects a similarity in meaning. We have seen, for example, semantic networks back in the 60s, the idea of psychologists. We have seen the idea of semantic vector spaces in linguistics, also very popular nowadays. And, for example, in philosophy, the idea of conceptual spaces. So, together with my brilliant PhD student, Simone Vigano, I hope he's here, at the time PhD, now soon to be PI at Neurospin, we asked ourselves a maybe naive, maybe bold, potentially both, maybe crazy question of what if the notion of semantic space is actually more than a metaphor, and what if we actually use the same neuronal circuitry to conceive concepts in our mind as the one that we use to actually navigate physical spaces. Then we reason that if this is the case, then the neural code for semantic representations should reflect some properties of the neural code for space, meaning that they should be indicating us direction between points and distances between points, which is something that we have been extremely well taught by Professor Moser, has been discovered by a neurophysiologist and described pretty well. In humans and also in other animal species, there are regions that are mostly located in the medial part of the brain, medial prefrontal cortex, entorhinal cortex, and retrosplenial cortex, connected functionally and structurally among each other that host neuronal populations that are crucial for representing spatial information. And for the sake of this talk, I'm going to concentrate on two types of cells, grid cells that we now know very well with their prototypical hexagonal arrangement of the firing fields tiling the entire navigated surface, and also head direction cells that are cells that encode specific heading direction when the animal moves around its environment. So how to test whether we are based upon the activity of those types of cells and those brain regions that are important for space when we think about concepts? This is a very, very hard question, because in order to do so, we should know first what is the low-dimensional nature of the space that govern our concepts. So, for example, concept of dog and cat. What are the two dimensions that are important for defining these concepts? And especially, what is their distance? How distant they are in our semantic space, this concept, and what is the direction that one needs to take if one wants to go from one to the other. So, of course, the problem is almost intractable as such, because we know our representation is very rich and also potentially variable across subjects. So we thought about attacking it by constructing and training subject to learn a novel two-dimensional object space that we taught subject was organized in discrete categories, that each category could be labeled by an arbitrary symbol. So these are features that we thought were a minimal requirement to be able to talk about this as a semantic space. So concretely, we taught subject to learn 16 novel objects, each of which was defined by a specific combination of a size and a pitch that this object generated during a very short animation. Then we taught subjects that these objects could be grouped into four different categories, and that each category could be labeled with a different name. Importantly, because we needed, in order for the analysis and the types of code we're interested, to have the geometry of this perceptual space very well controlled, we titrated the different sizes and pitches on the basis of the individual subject sensitivity to those continua, such that, in the end of the training, all subjects' perceptual spaces could be aligned one to another. So I'm going to give you a very short example of what this object looked like. These are two examples of the object that corresponded to the category care. Please. No, don't want to. Give it another go. No go? Okay. Oh. All right, I can. Oh, there is no sound. I'm sorry, there should be a sound. I can make a sound. Moss, beep, beep. So this is a dune stimulus, so it's going to be very big, very small, well, relatively small, but it's making a very high-pitched sound. This is a gull stimulus, it's bigger than the dune, and it's making an equally high-pitched sound. So you get the idea. It's an orthogonal combination of two features that the subject are learning to fuse together, and their task during the learning period was to associate each object to its corresponding category. So the learning curve indicated that after 8 days of training, they were pretty good at doing this, and we involved them in a longitudinal fMRI study. We tested them before and after this long training period in the fMRI, while they were presented with pseudorandom sequences of words and objects, such that we could recover and analyze the activity evoked by each of these stimuli. Importantly, this sequential presentation of objects and words, we thought that could be conceived as a path in the internal semantic space, and that each step, meaning each pairwise presentation of two stimuli in a sequence, could be associated with a specific distance in the semantic space, sorry, and a specific direction in the semantic space. So the first thing we looked for was a distance code. Is there a place in the brain where the distance in the semantic space across two concepts is encoded? And we looked for that with fMRI adaptation and multivoxel pattern analysis. Converging results indicated that indeed the ventromedial prefrontal cortex encodes this Euclidean distance in the semantic space. Of course, there was no such a code before subjects were trained, because there was no relationship between the words and the object themselves. Also, interestingly enough, we could, using multidimensional scaling, recover the exact geometry of the semantic space by taking the distributed pattern of activity of the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Only after learning, you can see that the geometrical distances and shape is equal to the one of the space that we injected into subject. But before learning, of course, there was not such a structure. The second and more challenging type of code that we were after was the grid-like code. And we capitalized on the previous work of Christian Doeller, who showed that we can use fMRI to approximate the signature of what would be potentially, and there are discussions going on, the activation of populations of grid cells. Doeller had subject navigating in a virtual environment while scanned in an fMRI, and he reasoned, capitalizing on the hexagonal orientation of the firing fields of grid cells and on the fact that several grid cells tend to be oriented in the same direction. He predicted that whenever subjects move along the physical space in the virtual environment along the orientation of the grid firing fields, then the bold signal should be high, while when subject move in directions that are not perfectly aligned to the grids, then the bold signal should be low. And indeed, he found that the entorhinal cortex, a region where that is densely populated by grid cells, the bold signal followed a six-fold periodicity as a function of all the direction that subject move in the physical space. So we used a somewhat similar approach, even though analytically different, because we used multivariate pattern analysis, assuming that whenever two directions in the semantic space, meaning pairs of words that imply a given direction in the semantic space, differ among themselves by 60 degrees or a multiple of 60 degrees, then the pattern of activity that they evoke should be very similar. While if two directions are not perfectly aligned on this on a 60 degree space, then their similarity should be proportional to their angular distance in the 60 degree space. So to give a very, very simple example, here we have these two directions differ by 180, is a multiple of 60, therefore we predict the pattern of similarity should be very similar, and these two differ by 90 degrees, not a multiple of 60, so the pattern of their evoked activity should be very dissimilar. So equipped with this predicted model, we looked at whether and where in the brain there were voxels that responded to our stimuli according to this prediction. And what we found was that indeed there were voxels that significantly responded in this way, and they were located in the right entorhinal cortex, really in the place that we expected them to be. And the pattern of dissimilarity, to confirm the analysis, was modulated by the angular distance in the 60 degree space, as the model was predicting, of course. Interestingly, we could do the same reconstruction of the geometry of the space by taking as an input for the multidimensional scaling the data from the entorhinal cortex, as we did for the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. But of course, the construction was impossible before the training, meaning that we really injected this new structure while training subjects to learn these new concepts in their brain. Because this first experiment was the first in which we found such an effect, and because the semantic space was really, really small and did not allow us to firmly conclude about the greatness of our effect, because this six-fold periodicity correlated also with a two-fold periodical model, we ran a second experiment, which we had a bigger semantic space with 9 words that subject actually managed to learn, 5 distances among them, and 16 directions. So this was the main difference between the new study compared to the old one. And I go very fast up here because we confirm tightly the observation that we made in the first experiment. So there is a beautiful parametric distance effect in the Euclidean two-dimensional space in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So this analyzed through fMRI adaptation. And also, as for grid-like signal, the grid-like model is much larger because we have many more distances, but the idea is exactly the same. Searchlight analysis, we end up again with the right intermediate prefrontal cortex hosting this exadirectional modulated kind of signal that is evocative of the presence of grid cells encoding these kinds of directional and distance information potentially. In this experiment, we added a new inquiry that was whether I was introducing you before the presence of head direction cells that differently from grid cells prefer one single direction. So these head direction cells really indicate a kind of a mental compass because they really indicate the heading direction of the animal. So do we activate some sort of the same sort of code when we navigate physical space? So here we reason that if there is such a code for absolute direction, then within the idea of fMRI adaptation, whenever we present pairs of words that imply a movement in the same direction in the semantic space, if the two words are close one after the other, then the fMRI should show adaptation, and the amount of adaptation should scale with the time elapsed between the two presentations of the same implied direction. So we did this, and the results show a set of regions in the brain that show this absolute code type of response, including precuneus and the retrosplenial cortex that contains head direction cells. And interestingly, the amount of adaptation in those regions, especially in the precuneus, but also there is a tendency in the retrosplenial cortex, correlate with the subject performance in a semantic comparison task, meaning that in a task in which they have to compare these new words and decide whether the first or the second one related to an object that was smaller or higher in pitch or in size. So far, so good. So these three types of information, distance direction and absolute exadirectional and absolute directions, encoded for semantic spaces. However, the concepts that we tested with this, the paradigm that we used, were all at the same hierarchical level, meaning that they were all subordinate of the same general category. However, especially through the use of language, we use very often ways to categorize the words that have the form of hierarchical trees. So we know that cats and dogs are mammals, then mammals and fishes are animals, etc., in the form of more and more abstract categories. So the question was, can these brain regions that are important for navigation also encode hierarchical relationship among concepts? So in order to do so, again, the same, very similar design, but at this point, not only subjects were taught that there were categories in that we could group them, but that these groups could be further grouped into higher level categories. So we ended up with 16 objects, 4 category, 2 superordinate category. Interestingly, we didn't teach subject this hierarchical structure explicitly, but we just trained them to associate an object with this subordinate category and the same object with its superordinate category, hoping that through training, the brain would implicitly build up a tree structure encoding these kinds of associations. So one very simple, maybe it's not the right one, but a simple mechanism that the brain could use to implement a hierarchical representation is to change the way in which it encodes the concept themselves, such that the categorical tree could, the hierarchical tree could emerge. So the idea here is, if you only have to play around the similarity, one way to construct a tree is to increase superordinate and subordinate similarity, and to increase subordinate level similarity. So we looked for traces of these kinds of patterns of similarity among the words that we taught subjects by using a region of interest approach. We looked at in the hippocampus that we segmented in three regions, anterior, posterior, and mid, and then the entorhinal cortex. And we looked for, using a model-based representational similarity analysis, whether these areas encode superordinate and subordinate categories similarly, and subordinate categories similar to each other. And the only area among the four that represent the words in a way that reflects this pattern of similarity was the entorhinal cortex. And indeed, if we use multidimensional scaling, we can see that the two categories are very well separated with each other, and the two subordinate are closer to each other than they are to the superordinate one. The same kind of hierarchical tree emerges if you use a hierarchical clustering method of analysis that show really that in the entorhinal cortex, we can kind of reveal this kind of hierarchical tree that has been constructed spontaneously through this simple associative learning. As a conclusion, out of this initial work, I think that we can start seeing that concepts, at least when they are organized along two dimensions, and their relations, including hierarchical relations, seem to be encoded in brain regions that are typically also involved in spatial navigation, and through distance-based, grid-like, and absolute directional codes that we can see. And therefore, we think that this may represent a novel example of neural recycling, a concept so dear to Stan, thinking that the neuromachinery that potentially has primarily evolved to present and navigate the physical space, that's the key evolutionary relevant function, but that in humans can be recycled to also encode relations and structures between concept in an internal representational space. I want to make just a couple of final remarks here very quickly. I think that this line of research that indicates space and high-level abstract thinking closely related is fascinating, and that, as we discussed already a little bit before, it may open up new avenues for better understanding neurological diseases linked to the degeneration of these regions that I highlighted, especially the mediotemporal lobes. Some future directions that I'm going to explore in my lab are, first, similarly to what we have heard, to try and characterize the development of this brain navigation system during the first days, weeks, and months in human babies. Second, to probe its role in reasoning, in the abstraction of structure, in inference making, and in metaphor processing. So as you can understand, space as the fabric of thought, yes, maybe. It's more a research agenda than an established fact, but this is the direction. And the red words highlighted there are all spatial-related words, and we shall not forget that we really, really massively use these kind of terms and concepts to refer to our thinking, and I think that this must mean something. Thank you for your attention and for my collaboration.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.